Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right. Hello. Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano. And on the phone, as I do each week, I have Chris Sheridan on the line. How are you?
Great, Jason. Great to be here.
Great to have you here, my friend. Well, not here, but in the ether.
Everywhere.
Here, there, and nowhere. Everywhere.
All at once.
Exactly. Yeah. In the spirit of that here, there, and everywhere, we're actually going to be talking about Edgar Cayce today and his book. It's not his book, but it's a book based on his readings. 650 readings, I believe, they went through of his life readings. And they pulled out information dealing with individuals on their incarnations in Atlantis. Edgar Cayce believed that we had multiple incarnations, a reincarnation type belief, and that, oftentimes they were in periods of history that are not part of what we can consider today, like an academic or a sort of historical understanding. In other words, it's more of an alternative version, a metaphysical version, if you will, of history. So, of course, there are different epochs and different eons of time. One of them is this time where Atlantis is a powerful civilization. Of course, everyone's heard of Atlantis, but we're going to go a little bit into that today and talk about that. I am the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. Chris is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. Both of our books are available on Amazon or on our websites at cosmiceye.org, which is mine, and Chris's is chrissheridan.com. I wanted to also encourage everybody out there who's listening, who enjoys the show, if you can, to become a supporter of Cosmic Eye. You can do so for as little as 99 cents a month. There's a package for 99 cents a month, $4.99 a month, and $9.99 per month. I mean, if you can afford it, please do contribute to our cause. We feel like we're doing great work here, and we're excited to share it with you. But of course, we have expenses as well, like everyone does. And if you could help us to support the show, that would be absolutely fantastic. So you can go to anchor.fm/cosmiceye, and you'll see become a supporter on there. You can click on that. So enough of the plugging of our stuff. Let us get into On Atlantis by Edgar Evans Cayce. It's a small book. Has very small print. You were talking about that when we were talking about this yesterday. So you may want to have a magnifying glass or some reading glasses if you're getting up in years like the two of us are. If you have your young, strong eyes, you're going to be just fine. It's a fantastic little book, though. One of the interesting things about it, like I said, is it's not really a linear story per se. It's different predictions and different life readings that Edgar Cayce made at different times in history. A lot of this stuff comes from the 30s, from the 20s, from the 40s. And there were different understandings of history, of archaeology, of anthropology at these different times when he was giving these readings. And the interesting thing about it, and one of the things that the book supports, is that he pushes back human civilization quite a bit. Quite a bit, and I'm sure you noticed that. I found that interesting. Did you like that portion of those readings where he's pushing back these dates, and actually some of them are being supported by the findings of science now, archaeological findings, and so on.
Yeah, it's very much in line with the current trend with maybe non-mainstream, historians and archaeologists that. Structures and civilizations and cultural items, technologies, and go way back further. And it kind of upsets the timeline, the neat, well, we were, Stone Age and then, Bronze Age and copper and all this stuff. Although there is ample evidence of that, these predictions or setting the time scale back kind of disrupts that. And it's maybe come more mainstream or more popular now, but at the time that he did it, that was kind of unheard of.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that makes it interesting.
Well, it makes it interesting though. And, even today where I think there's a pretty, obviously there's a lot more of this kind of information out today. You know, best-selling books by, you know, Graham Hancock and some of those guys, and Jim Mars, and I'm thinking of these different Atlantis guys, a few of them are escaping my mind, but there's a lot of very popular authors that that are following up on these ideas in different ways. And that was not the case in the 20s, 30s, and 40s by any means. Edgar Cayce was certainly one of the earlier people investigating a lot of these ideas. Although the Atlantis story from Plato has captured people's imaginations, I imagine, since, you know, since it was first told back in Plato's day. So this is really nothing new. These are new iterations kind of explorations of the Atlantis idea. One of the things that he comes across with that I think is very, very interesting and kind of applicable is that, it's like you were saying. You all right?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Knock that out.
You're not dying on me, are you?
No, hang on.
Okay, because I may have to do
you can edit that out, right?
I may, well, we could, or I could just leave it in because I may have to do a life reading for you once you're done with this. We'll see how
call life alert.
Call life alert, exactly, and say, hey, Chris Sheridan's choking to death. Can you please go save him?
Yeah, it'd be like that Atlanta story. Cough, cough.
So,
well, Atlantis was kind of off the wall anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, at any kind of time frame to talk about. I was a latecomer to really seriously entertaining that possibility, which is much more compelling now than it was maybe even 20 years ago for me.
Yeah, I'm finding the same thing. I'm finding the same thing. It's like I was always kind of open to it. I actually have to thank my friend's mom, Dixie Owen, who shared this book with me when I was young. And I really enjoyed it, and it opened up my mind to this idea, but I really hadn't thought about it much. And that was in, I think, junior high or high school, early high school. And so I didn't really, because the book is from actually, what, 1967, 1968, something like this.
Which was about 20-some years after Cayce passed, put together by his sons.
Yeah, exactly. Sons. Exactly. And drawn from the rich library of his readings. It still, people still to this day go to ARE, which is their organization, Edgar Cayce's organization. And ARE stands for the Association for Research and Enlightenment. You can find that at edgarcayce.org, EDGARCAYCE.org. There is a lot of fantastic information there. So people still go there to this day to read his readings of the past, his life readings, and try to find out information about ancient mysteries and different civilizations, Atlantis, spiritual development, meditation, etc. I mean, he was known as America's greatest psychic.
The sleeping psychic,
exactly. He would go into sort of a trance phase where he would, what he called contact cosmic consciousness, I think he would say. And he would go and bring back this information. People would record it. They could ask him questions while he was in this state. He wasn't really sleeping per se. He was in more of a very deep state of meditation is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So there still is a lot of interest in his work. It's still quite valid. He's talked about everything from crop circles to Atlantis to ancient DNA research, Egyptian heritage, prophecies, etc., astrology. Fantastic site that edgarcayce.org. And the
thing I found interesting in sort of the background story with Cayce is that his initial claim to fame and how he really did the bulk of his initial work was in medical diagnoses. And these were actually tested at the time against, you know, the doctors and maybe eventually what they did find. And he was correct quite a bit of the time. So it's one thing to speculate about ancient history or the future or some of these kinds of things that maybe you can't readily prove. But these were here and now patients, and these were doctors at the time that found that he was accurate at least 90% of the time. I think 92 or 95.
Something like that, yeah.
But even 90, that's
astonishingly high.
And it was proven, if, you know, however much you can prove something like that. And that was his initial thing. So I think that really gave him a lot of legitimacy, if you will, early on, because, wow, it's either the scientists are on board with this. It was maybe odd how it came about, but it was undeniable that he was accurate.
Exactly. No, it's so fascinating. And I mean, he comes, it's an interesting background as well. I mean, he was born in 1877 and died in 1945. And he was from the South. The headquarters of ARE is actually Virginia Beach, Virginia. And he was from Kentucky. So, you know, he was very much immersed in that kind of old school Baptist Christian sort of faith as a child, and never really got away from that. He was very much a believer in the Bible, would read the Bible, I think once a time for every year he was old or something. So if he was 12 years old, he'd try to read it 12 times. If he was 45, he'd try to read it 45 times that year or something. He's some sort of a plan like that. So he definitely held fast to his biblical heritage, and yet at the same time, he's still known as one of the fathers of the New Age movement, bringing in these ideas of psychic forces, chakras, radical diets. They don't seem so radical anymore. He was one of the first people to start talking about the idea of food combining, and the idea that acidic and alkaline diets, and it's, you know, the properties in food, that this was something at the time which was just unheard of. So really quite a pioneer, mm-hmm. And still maintained his sort of fundamentalist, I don't want to say fundamentalist, but maintained his Christian roots, a more, what we would consider maybe a more evangelical, probably fundamentalist sort of understanding. Obviously, he did not share in those kind of narrow views of the Bible, oftentimes
the earth was, and the universe were older than 6,000 years.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty sure about that.
It's pretty safe to say that. So I think he obviously took, a more liberal view of the Bible, but he still held much reverence, for it and for his upbringing as a Christian, which I find very interesting.
Very much.
One of the interesting things about, let me just kind of get into this. There's a little overview in the book that I find very helpful. So this is sort of in a nutshell, the ideas that this book contains and some of the ideas about Atlantis, and some of this is more or less an overview of Edgar Cayce's sort of belief and readings on Atlantis. So first of all, number one, man has existed in the earth or on the earth for at least 10 million years, at least 10 million years. So that obviously is a much greater span of time than we would give to man today. Although I think they push back our date to something like a million years ago, something like that. I think they have evidence of some bones that look pretty humanoid. I can't remember which find that was. So really, that view is probably closer to what we're finding now in science, as opposed to what at that time was being thought in science. I think around at that time, they were thinking man was maybe at the latest 100,000 years old or something. Is that your recollection of that?
Something, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
that sounds about right. And the worldview of the universe up until the late 1920s, the known universe, astronomers fully believed, was just what we see in the Milky Way. We didn't really have this notion of distant galaxies, much less millions of galaxies that is commonplace to knowledge today.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then King Tut discovery in the early 20s, that really expanded what we knew about Egyptian civilization because everything was so intact. So some things were being shifted around that time, expanding and getting closer to history, history maybe getting pushed back, but he really wasn't bound by any of that.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I just heard our buddy in the background. It's odd because it's 4:15. Usually he's out at 3 o'clock. So
It's a slow Saturday.
It's a slow Saturday. Yeah.
The barking interruption. The helicopter should be
Should be coming in, and then someone should be raiding your neighbors next door soon. The FBI will be screaming over bullhorns soon. So it should be a good
time. I live
time.
In a nice neighborhood. Well,
I kid. Well, yeah.
it's still L.A.
He lives in Compton. Anyway, so the second idea is that Atlantis was one of the places where man as such developed. Man as such. So essentially what he's getting into is a much different idea than the idea that modern science has of how we sort of evolved from different creatures, and kind of there's this upward sort of movement up through, you know, amoeba up to sort of a primeval, you know, sort of ape-like man into what we are today. There's a quite a different outlook in the sort of occult view or esoteric view of our development, which gets into the next portion of this, that man's origin was as a spirit, not a physical body. Mm-hmm. These souls projected themselves into matter, probably for their own diversion. In other words, for, you know, to experience what it was like to be in a material body, to enjoy that. And, you know, in some cases, in corrupt ways, and through the use of his creative powers for selfish purposes, man became entangled in matter or materiality to such an extent that he nearly forgot his divine origin and nature, which kind of brings us back to some of our Gnostic ideas that we've been discussing over the last shows, where man has a spark of divinity within himself. He just needs to get back to that and kind of release that and find that spiritual self within again. We've sort of forgotten by being tangled up in this material world. It's kind of a similar idea. So another mm-hmm. idea that he has is a very long time ago. This his scope of history goes again way back to at least 10 million years ago. Very long time ago, man attained great technological progress equal to, if not surpassing, that existing today. Which is an interesting idea, because again, we think we are the pinnacle of development. We think our technology is the pinnacle of what, you know, what has been achieved on the earth and in the universe. In some cases, we even think that. And we've made of ourselves an idol in a way, and our own technologies we've turned into an idol. So that's kind of an interesting point. And this, mind you, is being said in the 30s, well before, you know, television is popular, well before wireless communications via cell phones, and well before, I mean, all these things were being developed, but they certainly weren't well known. And, you know, now we live in the pinnacle of where we find ourselves today with the technologies we have. And in essence, I mean, he was saying the same thing. You know, you and I often talk about, what are we doing with these technologies? You know, we have to ask ourselves that, yes, we have advancements in certain areas of technological development, but philosophically speaking, metaphysically speaking, esoterically speaking, where's our soul in all this? Do you know what I mean? And right. And then, you know, we've got to look at, what are these technologies good for if we lose our soul in the process? I mean, they're neat. It's fun to play video games online and, you know, read gossip and watch a guy get kicked in the nuts at the AMPM. But I mean, is that the pinnacle and the highest use of this technology? Let's ask ourselves that. Or is there much more we could be doing with it? I mean, granted, there are plenty of people doing amazing things online. You know, the networked possibility of computers is being used to explore the universe and all these different things. I grant that. But the bulk of the use of what we're doing online is most of the time, you know, I wouldn't say it's of a spiritual nature, would you?
Not so much. Not only have we kind of forgotten our souls in this, you know, pursuit of technology, in some ways we've deferred it and we've turned it over to technology. I see all the time articles that, well, how AI can save us from that, and well, how AI can, artificial intelligence, you know, computer language,
sure,
computer thinking. Of course, the computer is just a human creation, so how good is it going to be anyway?
Well, exactly. We, you know, that's the thing, is we're projecting our own capabilities onto something that we've created and then hoping that thing is going to save us. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier.
it's very similar, I think, to the idea that, for example, aliens are going to come down and grace us with more technological advancements than they already have with, you know, in the past, if we believe that. And that will save us now. But we never make the, we never ask the question, is the technology and maybe the use of the technology the problem? Maybe the things we've created are beyond our capabilities philosophically and metaphysically speaking, you know, to use them constructively. Maybe we need to think about developing our spiritual and, you know, and philosophical capacities to a greater degree, and then we can use the technology we have better. You know, maybe
we're our soul technology.
Exactly. So maybe we're asking soul tech. I love it. So maybe we're asking some questions that aren't, you know, that aren't the best questions to be asking. And I think Casey was talking about that. So let me quickly get into the fifth idea that's sort of presented in this book. So just as the misuse of their spiritual powers brought turmoil, strife, and questioning among themselves, this is among the Atlanteans, men's misuse of scientific and material achievements brought physical destruction in the earth. So in essence, you know, in that, it's a sort of a cautionary tale. We know from the story, from Plato's story, that the Atlanteans spread out all over, and they were one of the most highly advanced civilizations, and the Greek, and he spoke of them as battling with the Greeks and so on, and that they eventually tried to take over the world, and for that, that the gods punished them. Poseidon had given them that realm, that sort of ocean realm, to flourish in, and you know, they basically misused some of the you know, some of the gifts that they were given by the gods, and in turn were punished by the gods and destroyed for their hubris, which is a big theme amongst Greek mythology to begin with. But it's one we need to learn, a lesson we need to still learn today. You know, it's like the story of Icarus. You know, we've talked about that many times, and you talk about that in your book as well.
Flying too close to the sun, caught up in the ecstasy of the
experience, yeah, and not thinking about the consequences of things. So we're so excited and enamored with our own technological advance, and we forget, okay, well, what is this being used for? How is this damaging the earth? How is it helping the earth? What is it doing socially? What is it doing psychologically to us? Asking those questions before we unleash these new technologies on the world would probably be of great benefit to us. One of the interesting things about both Casey's readings and Manly Hall's, by the way, check out, there's a lecture on YouTube. There's many of them. If you just put in Manly Hall, Atlantis, Gods of Antiquity, that's the title of it, isn't it?
Yes.
You will see many, many lectures with Manly Hall. It's about an hour and 16 minutes. I think that's the one that you'll listen to, if you want to hear Manly Hall's actual lecture. And he talks a lot about Atlantis not being as a single place. He's saying that Poseidon, I think is how he pronounces it, was the last island in a chain. So there were actually seven main islands or main sort of dispersions of this Atlantean culture, and in essence, it was like a vast kingdom, and they controlled a pretty wide expanse of the Mediterranean world, you know, from Europe to into North Africa and maybe possibly even further. But what happens is that there is this cataclysmic event that takes place, and Casey really goes into depth in this, and Manly Hall doesn't speak so much about it, but basically this cataclysm comes about through misuse of their technology. So they had something like maybe what we would consider atomic energy, or perhaps some kind of solar energy that was, or geothermal energy, something that involved crystals and the use of geothermal energy, possibly volcanic activity, something to this effect. I mean, he's pretty, it's not so specific in the book, but there's, you know, hints at it, that maybe it's something like an atomic energy or some sort of power. But apparently it was a very great power. They misused it and used it for destructive purposes. So what happens is they created a cataclysm, basically. Volcanic activity, earthquakes, flooding, etc. And then they, but this happened over a period of time. That last island, Poseidon, was the last sort of bastion of their culture. But over hundreds, possibly thousands of years, there was a dispersion of different Atlantean peoples to different places. One of those places is speculated to be Egypt. One of those places is the Mayan people. I mean, they landed in Mexico and Guatemala and Nicaragua and along those areas in South America and Central America. And other places as well. I think he spoke about the Pyrenees, where they went to Spain. And then there's a speculation that maybe the Basque people are connected to that, since their language is not connected to any Indo-European languages. So a lot of really interesting connections there. I liked a lot how Manly Hall talked about the dispersion, and he brought up some of the mythologies in those different places. Do you remember that section when he was talking about Awanis?
The fish god,
yeah,
and then arrived from the sea.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about those and about Quetzalcoatl? Do you remember those stories and a little bit of those connections?
I do in general, not specifically with this. I was focusing a little more on the technology and history aspect of the Atlantean. But that this, you know, diaspora, this, emanating out from what was left of Atlantis or the archipelago.
Yeah.
It explains technology, like that there's pyramids. You were saying there's language, mm-hmm. things that don't fit in the normal ones, that they maybe have a different origin. But they have something in common with different places.
Well, speaking of that,
around the world.
Speaking of that, really quickly, in the Aztec culture and in the Mayan culture, there's a word they believe they're derived from a civilization in the East. They actually have this in mythology, a place called Aztlan or Atlan, and that's pretty wild. So. You know, that was an interesting connection. Also, what you're just saying is a lot of there's a lot of language cognates in the names of places. For example, and these are in Asia Minor, sort of Near East cities, Chol, and then in Central America you have Cholula. Asia Minor areas, or Turkey and ancient Near East areas, Kolua Khan in Central America. In the East again, Zuivana, in Central America is Zuivan, and so on and so forth. I mean, so there's interesting language parallels also that would suggest maybe a migration or a dispersion of some sort. Whether it was Atlanteans or not is, you know, remains to be seen. But there's some interesting arguments are definitely made. Continue. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh yeah, well, and definitely the feathered serpent of Quetzalcoatl. Of course, we have, you know, the dragon in the East, and
well, and that
it comes up a lot.
That story is the story of a bringer of culture and a bringer of writing and technology to that specific land, to the Mayans. But the Incans also have Aztecs, the Mayans, Incans, I believe, have a similar mythology of a bringer of knowledge.
Well, we have Hermes.
Sure.
You know, who brought knowledge? Certainly. Other
Mercury, Mercurius to the Romans, and Thoth to the Egyptians. Right. We spoke about him earlier.
We did, and others that have brought. Well, it was Prometheus brought fire.
Mm-hmm.
He got punished for it, but that plays into the alien thing too. That, well, it came from the sky, but if the Atlanteans were an island. Empire, I guess, they would have to come from the sea if they were going to go to some other land.
Sure.
Or if they still had some of their potential aircraft technology, maybe they did come, on a feathered serpent,
sure.
Or some kind of a thing. So even these sky gods and, you know, sea deities could have a more human or, you know, ancestral human origin. It doesn't have to necessarily be extraterrestrial. It could have been behind this, you know, what Manly Hall calls the dark curtain of history, you know, behind which we really don't know. There isn't enough evidence to piece something together, but there's enough to know that there's something behind there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and that's the challenge with the whole idea of Atlantis. I mean, most of this whole, you know, thrust of this information is based on, you know, the one place where it's found is in Plato's Critias and Timaeus, two works that where the story is found, and then it's, you know, extrapolated out from there. But it's, you know, it's an interesting and compelling story. The thing that's, I think, challenging for people today is that we think of history in a different way than the ancient mind did. History to us is evidence, is, you know, a sort of a historical record or a transcript of the event, or it's some sort of archaeological or physical evidence. That's what we consider history. Ancient civilizations had a much broader view of history. So their history would include, you know, legend and mythology, and it would include a certain reverence and usually some spiritual content in it as well. It wasn't just interested in the fact of the matter, you know, not like, was that Dragnet? Just the facts, ma'am?
Yes, exactly.
They were not interested in just the facts, ma'am. They were interested in the meaning. And that's one of the things we've lost in our understanding of mythology. We even today will say, well, it's just, you okay? Mm-hmm. Again? Yeah. You know, we'll still say today disparagingly, oh, that's just a myth. That's just a myth, meaning that something is untrue. Whereas the historical, you know, the ancients historically had an idea of a myth or a story as being something truer than fact. Truer than fact, something spiritually true, something esoterically true.
Well, facts and temporal things come and go.
Sure.
But a myth, if it's archetypal and really essential at its core, should and will take place and repeat itself and be relevant in any time or place.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's beyond that.
Exactly. Paradigm. It's beyond the temporal. The time-based knowledge that we get stuck in so often. But the, you know, the question is really, you know, is not so much, I think, in some ways, it's an interesting question. I like, it'd be neat to know, you know, whether or not this information is quote unquote factual. But I think more importantly, we have to ask ourselves, why is the story still compelling to us? I mean, it's at least, you know, 2,500 years old in Plato's time. You know, we're still interested in a story that's been told for at least 2,500 years. Obviously, you know, there's something in it that gets us. And you know, I think one of the things is that it opens up an idea of an alternative history. You know, a more cyclical nature of history, not this kind of linear, straight line version of history that we have today, you know, this sort of slow, painful evolution and then some cataclysms and then just gradual upward development. It's a more cyclical nature of history when we think that, you know, hey, there was possibly civilizations here which have left no trace because they are so ancient, we have no idea how far in the past they go. You know, and it's, I think that Atlantis, for example, is probably one of those type of things. If it existed, it's so ancient that it's likely that we will never find any physical evidence of it. And it's quite possible that there was such a cataclysmic event that everything was buried or even, you know, melted. If they had something like, for example, a proto-atomic weapon or some sort of, you know, destructive capabilities, they could have decimated or atomized their entire cultures and all the peoples around them. And then the only people that were left were the more quote unquote primitive people who were living in caves because they were away from the devastation. Do you know what I mean? So it places a very different outlook on it then. It's like, well, then of course, and it's quite possible that the Earth's changed its form, that land has shifted. If a volcano came and covered everything and then seas covered that, how would we find it? You know, if there were a civilization under there, look at if, for example, Manhattan were, you know, were under the sea and buried under lava, how would you know it was there?
Right.
But
well, Pompeii, that was a fairly recent discovery, late 1800s.
There's a great example. A great example.
And, you know, 79 AD, I think, is when Vesuvius took it out in Herculaneum. But it was immaculately preserved. And
exactly.
I've seen that they had hot and cold water tubs, and they had things that you really didn't think that they would have had back then. Because, you know, even just within recorded history, we've seen, well, to say that they were more advanced, they were definitely more advanced than people in the Middle Ages, 1,000 years later, were.
Absolutely.
In the Dark Ages, and all the way they threw it up into the Renaissance, you know, they were definitely more advanced. So we can see this even in, you know, very much, you know, visual and empirical evidence that this kind of thing has happened, that it already does disrupt this, you know, kind of gradual thing. And another thing that's, I think, can be unsettling about this Atlantis, the Atlantean hypothesis, I guess, is, you know, with the traditional, okay, we evolved from monkeys, and you know, we got hominids and, you know, Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, and on the way up to the Homo sapiens, we see ourselves at the pinnacle. We are it. We have evolved from a lower form and we're on top. Well, if you consider that, whether it's alien or Atlantean or other origin, and maybe if we have an ancestry that's higher up than we are, actually, I think that's kind of cool because it gives us hope that we can keep on going. If we're just, you know, monkey matter, then maybe we're not that far out of the trees and we're destined to pick our butts in the zoo in front of people. You know, I don't know.
Well, yeah. What kind of spiritual legacy are we leaving for the next generations with that kind of mythology? And that evolutionary view of life is, you have to remember, a sort of a scientific mythology. There is evidence that things evolve. I'm not saying that evolution is not a real thing. What I'm saying is the viewpoint, the scientific and scientism-oriented viewpoint, is that that's all there is. There's this sort of straight line, and we are that pinnacle of technological and evolutionary success that this evolutionary force, this invisible force, is seeking after, which is interesting to me because you believe in something that you can't pin a label on, evolution, we'll call it. And it is intelligent, it is developing, it is happening behind the scenes, and it's a cause. And you can't see it, you can't pinpoint it under a microscope, and yet you believe in it, yet you will say, there's no possibility that there's any higher intelligence in the universe. There's no possibility for God or the gods or anything like that. But you'll believe in a quote unquote blind intelligent force such as evolution. And again, I'm not saying that I don't believe in certain area aspects of evolution, but you know, just to say that that is the only thing at work in the universe, I think is we're cheating ourselves out of a legacy. And I think you're right. You know, if we look back at some of these societies, you know, the Greek, the Atlantean, you know, classical ancient Chinese culture, the Dravidian culture in India, ancient cultures in Babylon and Chaldea and so on, Egypt. We see that, you know, there were levels even in, you know, in sort of known history where there were these golden ages that, you know, where things were achieved, that remarkable things were achieved. Yet maybe, yes, the technology, quote unquote, was less developed. But what about the philosophical and metaphysical and spiritual capabilities within man? Mm-hmm. You know, were they perhaps much more developed than we are today? Because we've focused so much on the material, we've lost part of our heritage. Is that what some of these myths are pointing at? That there was a golden age of a more spiritual and mental sort of life where we are perhaps, like, for example, one of the things that is hypothesized about the Atlanteans is that they had more psychic abilities than we have. It's possible that the reason why, for example, we can't find any evidence of the Cyclopean buildings and so on, or any evidence of, for example, we don't know exactly how the pyramids were built and can't really even manage to do that today. There may be no evidence for it because they may be using a completely different form of building. They may be using some kind of levitation. They may be using their minds in a way that we're unaware of and have forgotten. I don't know. I'm not saying that's the case, but anything is possible. You know, the world is mysterious. And it's quite possible that, you know, with all of our emphasis on thinking and materialism and technological development, that we've lost the capability to do some of these things that we might have been able to do. Telekinesis might have been possible. Psychic, you know, different psychic powers, different, you know, different realms of understanding and being that we have no connection to anymore because we've lost it. I think that's what a lot of the you know, the new mind expansion and drug cultures are going after. They're trying to tap into some of those areas in a chemical way, but they're, you know, they're trying to access those different parts of ourselves, maybe that we've let lie dormant for so long that they've kind of gone underground, which leads
from lack of use,
which leads then into that understanding that Manly Hall is talking about, how Atlantis might be representative of something that's went underwater, underground, or unconscious in us that was higher, you know, in a purely sort of metaphorical or, you know, analogy type way, that Atlantis stands for some sort of powers that we used to have that went dormant and went under the water and were destroyed and covered over. They're not gone.
Maybe they had to be.
Maybe they did.
Maybe because they did. If it was... is misused that poorly, whether it's, you know, physical technology with power and destruction and bombs and even thought rays, I guess.
Sure.
But if also you could read people's minds, you could do things like that. We just are prone to misusing that anyway. It doesn't really matter with the technology, whether it's, you know, software inside using our, you know, psychic abilities, or whether it's the hardware of our weapons and things. You know, there's always a possibility of misuse. Maybe it's a good thing we don't have a lot of those psychic powers. If you could turn thought into action, every bad comment on Twitter would result in destruction.
No, it's true. So it's perhaps, I mean, there's, you know, there's a safety mechanism involved until we reach a higher, you know, philosophical or, you know, ideal within ourselves.
Which is why the mysteries required such the mystery schools, to be sure, required such a vetting of the candidates that they had to go through trials and initiations to prove that they weren't going to just misuse this stuff.
Exactly.
Which was just as we could easily misuse, you know, get your hands on a gun or, you know, cell phone or something today and misuse that. I think in antiquity, the symbolic language, maybe we were a lot closer, not in, you know, physical material technology, but our psychic abilities and technologies were much more developed. And so the possibility of misusing those was even greater because we have them more developed. I would go further to say nowadays we've grown so far away from that you could print and email everybody in the world all the ancient mystery secrets, and it really wouldn't help much because we really don't know how to go about it. We don't know what it means. We've gotten so far out of touch with that. It would just be a bunch of information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this, you know, this idea of Atlantis, this idea of much older history, the idea of the, you know, the spiritual coming into the material, that's another thing. We didn't get into that in this discussion, but there's whole sections and readings about different life forms that existed possibly at this time. At least Edgar Cayce thought so. And there's a whole class of people that are slaves, what the Atlanteans called things. And they were these sort of hybrids. And they were very, like, apparently dull, you know, and had very little connection to their spiritual side. And the Atlanteans, particularly, then we didn't get into this either, but I highly recommend this book, Edgar Cayce on Atlantis. But there's two factions of Atlanteans. There's the sons of Belial or Belial, and then these sons or children of the Law of One. The Law of One are the sort of good guys in essence, and the Belial folks are quote unquote the bad guys, and they're misusing technology and enslaving people and using certain less developed individuals as essentially as slaves. And they're the productive entities that, that produce everything for this higher class of individuals. So there's some of that going on as well. And then apparently it seems there's a battle between these sons of the Law of One and the sons of Belial. And that's what ends up in the cataclysmic events that occur. There's two major cataclysms, I believe, two or three of them. But, you know, there's different ideas of these stories and so on. And it's a fascinating read. I highly recommend it. Let me read just one.
Can I just throw one thing before you close up?
Absolutely.
What I found interesting and different, unique about Edgar Cayce's readings on Atlantis and the civilization is that whether it's Sue Donnelly's book, The Antediluvian World, or anything, the modern ones, you're talking about Graham Hancock and Gary Laxman and ancient archaeologists with alternative ideas that we have now. A lot of that's either geologic or oceanographic, if we're looking under the waves, or it's archaeological, that we're looking for artifacts. And then we also have the mythological, that has maybe transformed or transcended into other cultures, that there's, you know, leading back to this common thing. But, and he talks about those things as well, but he also connects on the human level or the individual person level of maybe someone who had a past life there. So it's, you know, it kind of adds that other element. And of course it's, you know, it's speculative or it's under hypnosis where he gets this reading, but it connects with a person at the time or somebody who maybe was linked to somebody at the time. And that's a little different than
it's very unique
discourse. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's very unique. Which is why this book is a valuable contribution to this field and why Edgar Cayce's work is still quite popular today. Let me read a little section I like at the end of this book, which is kind of summed up. Hold on a second here. Yeah, so this is kind of a question he's asking. He says, "What is your God? Are your ambitions only set in what you shall eat tomorrow or wherewith you shall be clothed? You of little faith, little hope, that allows such to become paramount issues in your own consciousness. Know you not that you are his, for you are of his making. He has not willed that you should perish, but has left it with you as to whether you will ever become aware of your relationship with him or not. Though there may be worlds, many universes, even solar systems greater than our own, the earth is a mere speck when considered even with our own solar system, yet the soul of man, your soul, encompasses all in this solar system or in others, for we are joint heirs with the universal force we call God, if we seek to do his bidding." So that was one of the readings that he did for an individual. And it really, he's pointing at something higher. You know, it's not just about Atlantis. It's not just about whether or not this or that historical dispersion of people happened or what have you. It's really, what is our relationship with the higher force, with our higher self? You know, how are we living our lives? Are we caught up only in the material world, or are we creating something that's more spiritual and philosophical and moving towards the good and the beautiful and so forth? So that's a great question. And I think that's something we always have to ask ourselves as we're studying this material is not just whether or not did it happen? Not, you know, is it an interesting take on some other, you know, esoteric or occult reading of things, but what is the value to me and how am I living my life today? You know, what am I focusing on? So, you know, with that, I leave you to think about that for yourself. Thank you for tuning in to the show. Again, please support us if you get a chance. Anchor.fm/Cosmic Eye. And you can support us there. Shoot us an email or leave us a question. If you'd like to hear us talk about anything under the sun, esoteric or otherwise, we would love to hear from you. So thanks again for joining us. Hope you have a great week. And thanks, Chris, for being here. You did a great job. I appreciate you.
Oh, thank you.
We will be here next week. Goodbye and God bless.